Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Francis Alonso in Washington. Islamic State insurgents overran the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra and its historic Roman-era ruins Thursday, leaving the militants in control of half of Syria. The takeover immediately threatened the 2,000-year-old UNESCO World Heritage Site with its towering colonnades, other ruins, and priceless artifacts. Irene Bukova is with UNESCO.
Destroying such heritage does not mean that you achieve some kind of a victory over your enemy. You don't convince other people that you are right.
The Islamic State fighters have demolished an array of antiquities in their advance across wide swaths of Iraq and Syria. So far, there's been no reports of any damage to those ruins. A senior U.S. diplomatic official is headed to Myanmar, where he will call for improved treatment of the country's Rohingya minority. It comes a day after Washington signaled it's willing to help find refuge for the thousands of members of the ethnic group stranded at sea. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Anthony Blinken says he will speak to the leaders of Myanmar Thursday about its own responsibilities to improve conditions in Rakhine State so that people don't feel that their only choice is to put their lives at risk by leaving and taking the sea. Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza has told the nation that upcoming elections will take place in peace and insisted that recent unrest in the capital Bujumbura is not representative of the rest of the country, even as the protests continue. Mr. Nkurunziza spoke on state television late on Wednesday. He announced that the upcoming parliamentary elections will be late by a week. VOA News. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE, said Thursday that both sides of the Ukrainian conflict have been violating the terms of the ceasefire agreement. The deputy chief of the OSCE Special Monitoring Mission to Ukraine, Alexander Hug, said to Kiev Thursday that parties in the conflict have continued fighting and used weapons which should have been withdrawn. The Donbas region, Hug said, remains unstable and unpredictable. China's Navy is reported to have issued 8 warning messages to a U.S. military surveillance plane that passed over a group of man-made islands that Beijing is using to secure its sweeping territorial claims in the disputed South China Sea. The report comes from CNN, whose reporters were allowed to fly in the Poseidon spy plane on Wednesday. CNN says the U.S. Navy's most advanced spy craft passed as low as 4,500 meters over the disputed reefs. Battles continued between Islamic militants and Libya's army, particularly on the coast. Edward Uranian reports.
Islamic militiamen clashed with the Libyan army in the port city of Benghazi, killing up to a dozen soldiers in 2 days of fighting, according to Libyan TV. The Libya Herald reported that 35 soldiers were wounded in the clashes in the Leithi district of the city. The Libyan military, which began an effort to drive Islamic militants out of Benghazi just over a year ago, is loyal to the internationally recognized government in Tobruk. Military units under Army Commander Khalifa Haftar now control most of the city. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Qatar has failed to improve conditions for migrant workers, according to an international rights group. Following international pressure, Qatar had promised a year ago to improve migrant labor rights, including changing policies that prevent workers from leaving the country or changing employers. In a report Thursday, Amnesty International said the reforms have not come fast enough, adding that little had changed for the 1.5 million migrant workers in Qatar. Without prompt action, the pledges Qatar made last year are at serious risk of being dismissed as a mere public relations stunt to ensure the Gulf state can cling to the hosting the 2022 World Cup, according to Amnesty. The U.S. state of California has declared a state of emergency for an area of coastline that has been hit with the worst oil spills in the state's recent history. Governor Jerry Brown issued the emergency proclamation late on Wednesday. A leak is reported to have come from a rupture in an offshore oil pipeline. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swohib. And coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
almost 37 million Ethiopians can vote this Sunday in the country's national election. Although Ethiopia's government is expected to easily win the poll for the fifth time, opposition parties are still campaigning in a last hope to win votes.
That's VOA's Martha van der Wolf reporting from Addis Ababa. Details coming up.
Also in the news, another protester was reported shot dead today in Burundi's capital, bringing the number of demonstrators killed in anti-government protests to 20. More than 900 migrants were rescued today on the Mediterranean by Italian and French naval vessels and a commercial ship.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Togo and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, another protester was reported shot dead today in Burundi's capital, bringing the number of demonstrators killed in anti-government protests to 20. The French news agency says the protester was killed in clashes with police. Meanwhile, the new defense minister called for unity within the army. Emmanuel Nahoinvukaye says the survival of Burundi as a nation depends on the cohesion of the army. He warns Burundi could become another Somalia if the army splinters. Demonstrations began in late April when President Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term in office. Last week, an army general tried to overthrow the president but failed. Speaking to the nation last night, President Nkurunziza said peace and security reign over 99.9% of the country. The UN Special Envoy for the Great Lakes region, Saeed Jenate, says there's an urgent need for dialogue to ease political tensions in Burundi.
More than 900 migrants were rescued today on the Mediterranean by Italian and French naval vessels and a commercial ship. Italian authorities report one death. Nearly 40,000 migrants, mostly from Africa and Syria, have sailed to European shores this year. Most embark from Libya after paying smugglers for space on often unsafe vessels. More than 1,800 migrants have drowned this year.
An estimated 37 million Ethiopians may vote this Sunday in the country's national election. Although Ethiopia's current government is expected to easily win the poll for the fifth time, opposition parties are still campaigning in a last bid to win votes. Marta van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa.
58 political parties are contesting Ethiopia's national election Sunday, May 24. It is widely expected that the ruling Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front Party, EPRDF, which has been in power since 1991, will win the vote. But opposition parties and their members, such as the Blue Party, are still campaigning. 23-year-old art student Lul Damtu is one of them.
The current government opposes another parties, is monopoly, socially, politically, and also religious. So I'm so annoyed. So I will join the Blue Party.
Eight big trucks drive through every neighborhood in the capital, Addis Ababa. The dozens of Blue Party supporters, mostly in their 20s and 30s, are standing on those trucks while giving flyers to passers-by or to those standing in line for taxis. When the Blue Party encounters a ruling party truck, it seems they are competing over who has the loudest sound system, each blasting campaign slogans and Ethiopian music. Standing on a truck and waving a flag with the party symbol of three circles is 28-year-old Blue Party volunteer Ephraim Sahaile Selassie. He says he knows his party will not win the elections.
Joseph Stalin, the Russian leader, once said that it's not the votes which decide. It is the person who counts that vote. So in this case, I have my own worries because I have many doubts about the fairness of this election.
The ruling party won the last Ethiopian elections in 2010 with all but one seat in parliament. Despite government claims these elections will be free and fair, most opposition parties have accused the government of harassing and intimidating their members. Human rights organizations have frequently criticized Ethiopia for repressing dissenting voices. Negust Wondervrouw is a 26-year-old housewife who joined the opposition party 2 years ago. She helps with public relations and organizing events because she opposes the government's policy. She says the ruling party's ethnic-based politics are her main problem because they are racist. Ethiopia's federal system is divided into 9 regional states based on ethnicity. The Blue Party, or Samayawi in Amharic, runs on the ideology of the liberal democracy. They are against the current ethnic federal system, saying that the ethnicity is used and the system does not include everyone. Samayawi is Ethiopia's youngest party, formed in 2012. Although the party had registered 400 candidates for the national elections, the National Electoral Board rejected 260 candidates, including their party leader. The board explained that the registered candidates were also members of another party, which is against the National Electoral Board's regulation. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
And the battles continue between Islamic militias and Libya's army, particularly on the coast. The Reuters news agency reports that the coastal town of Sirte, sandwiched between military forces loyal to rival governments in Tobruk and Tripoli, has now fallen under the control of Islamic State militants. Edward Iranian reports from Cairo.
Islamic militiamen clashed with the Libyan army in the port city of Benghazi, killing up to a dozen soldiers in 2 days of fighting, according to Libyan TV. The Libya Herald reported that 35 soldiers were wounded in the clashes in the Leithi district of the city. The Libyan military, which began an effort to drive Islamic militants out of Benghazi just over a year ago, is loyal to the internationally recognized government in Tobruk. Military units under Army Commander Khalifa Haftar now control most of the city. Zuru Kilani, a spokesman for the Islamist Majlis-e Shura Council, told Libyan TV, however, that his group destroyed a number of army tanks and vehicles carrying munitions, pushing the army back in one area.
He claims that the Majlis-e Shura held on to its positions, advancing on the army in the Leithi district.
He adds that his group destroyed 4 army tanks Wednesday and another Thursday, in addition to destroying army vehicles loaded with munitions. The Libya Herald reports on its website that most of the fighters battling the Libyan army in Benghazi are from other countries and are fighting for the Islamic State group rather than the local Ansar Sharia force. It adds that the foreign militants are fighting with a ferocity born out of the lack of a fear of death. Reuters news agency reports that militants loyal to the Islamic State group captured all of the port city of Sirte after heavy fighting with militiamen from the Islamist Fajr coalition Wednesday. The report said that the Fajr coalition withdrew to positions west of the city, which was the hometown of former dictator Muammar Gaddafi, who was ousted and killed in 2011. Since then, different factions have battled for control of the country, and in the past year, the Islamic State militants have begun fighting for territory. Libyan TV reported that the coastal highway, which runs through Sirte, was closed due to the presence of Islamic State militants in the area and urged travelers not to use the road. A Fajr militia commander, Mohammed Hossein, told Libyan TV his men are battling the militants. He says that fighting with Islamic State militants began before dawn and is continuing. He said that his men pushed the militants out of the southeastern entrance of the city. VOA could not independently confirm the claim.
Rival militias also fought in the coastal town of Ajdabiya, west of Benghazi. An Islamist commander claimed on Libyan TV that his men controlled the eastern and western entrances to the city. Forces aligned with the Libyan army control parts of the area, including the nearby oil port of Brega. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. President Obama is meeting with Tunisian President Baji Kaed Essebsi at the White House today. Mr. Obama is expected to announce U.S. military and economic aid for the struggling democracy. Mr. Essebsi says the agreement does not include a U.S. military base in Tunisia. The two presidents today released a joint statement to the Washington Post newspaper. It says the two nations have an unprecedented opportunity to forge an enduring partnership based on shared interests and values. The statement says the U.S. is committed to helping Tunisians build transparent, effective, and accountable institutions that truly serve the Tunisian people. Tunisia was the first country to embrace Arab Spring reforms and has conducted several successful elections since 2011. However, it has high youth unemployment and is in a volatile region. Since the Arab Spring, the U.S. has committed more than $570 million to Tunisia, plus two major loan guarantees. In related news, a militant faction called Libya Dawn is negotiating with Tunisian authorities for the release of one of their leaders. He's being held in Tunis on immigration violations. Last weekend, Libya Dawn abducted 172 Tunisians working in western Libya. Tunisia's foreign ministry says that 60 were released today. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Another protester was reported shot dead today in Burundi's capital, bringing to 20 the number of demonstrators killed in anti-government protests. More than 900 migrants were rescued today on the Mediterranean by Italian and French naval vessels and a commercial ship. And President Obama is meeting with Tunisian President Baji Kaed Essebsi at the White House today and would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
A clinical trial to test a new treatment for extensively drug-resistant TB, or XDR-TB, is underway in South Africa. The nonprofit TB Alliance and its partners launched the new study called NIX-TB. They say the trial is a critical step in the development of a universal treatment for all types of TB. It is the first study to test an all-oral drug regimen that has the potential to shorten, simplify, and improve treatment for XDR-TB. Dr. Mel Spiegelman is president and CEO of the Global Alliance for TB Drug and Development. He explains why this regimen has the potential for greater long-term benefits.
The big difference is the ability to take new drugs that all have not yet been approved, and in fact only one of the three has been approved for TB, and after doing quite a bit of preclinical work, taking them and using them together. It really is an attempt to leapfrog what otherwise would take probably decades of work if one were to do it in a more conventional manner of getting each drug approved and only then beginning to study them together.
As it stands now, people with XDR-TB, they can be on treatment for 2 years or longer with thousands of pills and injections. What makes this treatment for XDR-TB different from what is going on right now?
So first of all, in the vast majority of cases, XDR-TB is not cured, just to be clear. One of the latest studies showed that, in fact, if you follow these patients long enough, perhaps as little as 15% of them may be cured with the presently available treatments. So it's a pretty grim prognosis for anyone who has XDR-TB. The duration of therapy that we expect in the animal models that we've used, this treatment can actually cure in about 3 months. We will be treating patients for 6 months, and for those who have a good response but don't appear to be cured at 6 months, we would go on with treatment for another 3.
Where is the study going to be conducted?
The study is starting at 3 centers in South Africa. Because of the really experimental nature of the work, we are starting relatively slowly to make sure that we don't have any unanticipated side effects or problems. So we're starting slowly in 3 centers in South Africa, and then we intend to expand it after we get some initial experience with the regimen.
Why is XDR-TB so difficult to treat?
The major reason is because there's been so little investment in finding new treatments for TB that we don't have many new therapies, hardly any at all. And the old ones, just like the case in so many other infections, so many patients have become resistant, or the bugs have become resistant to the old treatments. So it's a combination of having outdated therapies and the lack of investment in trying to find new therapies. And that's why we get resistance that is virtually untreatable. This is not different or that different from what's really we're beginning to see in a lot of other infections where resistance is really becoming a major problem.
If the trials are successful, what is the next step?
The next step is twofold, or really threefold. The first next step, if the trial is successful, is to register this treatment so that it can be used in XDR patients worldwide. And to get that done as quickly as possible so that, in fact, we have a treatment for XDR-TB patients. The second step would be if the treatment is both efficacious enough and safe enough to actually then look at whether this would be a good treatment for multi-drug resistant TB who are not as resistant as the extensively resistant TB, which is XDR, and potentially even drug-sensitive TB, because what we're really trying to find is excellent short treatment that would be applicable to all patients with active TB and not even have to do what's called drug sensitivity testing and could treat all patients with the same very short regimen. In addition to that, if this treatment really is successful, we would be continuously looking at bringing in even newer and better drugs to further decrease the duration of therapy.
Will it be expensive for countries to acquire the treatment?
It really should not be, because each of the drugs that we're working with are really not that expensive to make at all. The big question when you get into treatments like this is really the volume, because the actual cost of manufacturing is very much dependent on how much is being manufactured. And if this is a treatment that can be widely used, then the actual cost of the drugs should really be very modest. And certainly the cost to the healthcare systems would go down dramatically by virtue of having an oral treatment, easy to administer, no hospitalization, no injectables, and all of those benefits.
Dr. Mel Spiegelman is president and CEO of the Global Alliance for TB Drug and Development. He spoke with me from Geneva, Switzerland.
South African President Jacob Zuma has apologized for violence against Mozambican nationals in Durban in recent weeks. Mr. Zuma made the apology at a banquet in the Mozambique capital, Maputo, hosted by President Filipe Nyusi. Mr. Zuma called the xenophobic violence in his country atrocious acts by a minority of South Africans. A Mozambican was one of the 7 people who died in the looting and riots in Durban. Last week, South Africa deported 400 undocumented Mozambican workers. More than 2,000 others fled their homes and returned to Mozambique during the violence.
Scientists have discovered in a desert area of northwest Kenya what are believed to be the world's oldest stone tools. The tools date back 3.3 million years, long before modern humans. The discovery also means that such tools were being used 700,000 years earlier than once thought. It is not known whether those who made these are the tools of our human ancestors. However, scientists say proto-humans had the thinking ability to create sharp-edged tools. The findings appear in the journal Nature.
And the environmental watchdog Greenpeace says scores of Chinese fishing boats are illegally fishing off West Africa, even though Beijing says they are within the law. Shannon Van Santa reports from Hong Kong that observers say one-fifth of China's distant water fishing fleet is operating in Africa.
The new report from Greenpeace says that over the span of a decade, 183 illegal fishing cases involving more than 100 Chinese ships were reported in the West African countries of Gambia, Guinea, Guinea-Bissau, Mauritania, Senegal, and Sierra Leone. Rashid Kong is head of Greenpeace East Asia's China Ocean Campaign.
The region was also hard hit by Ebola. So I think what we have found is that at least 16 cases of illegal fishing by Chinese boat that happened. So that's roughly about one case every 2 days.
China's foreign ministry has rejected the report, saying Chinese companies abided by the law and contributed to African economies through paying taxes, providing jobs, and increasing incomes, which is welcomed by local governments and their people. But Greenpeace says the Chinese frequently supplied incorrect identification information that sometimes suggested they were in Mexican waters or even on land to avoid detection. Kong says many ships also underreported their catches to avoid paying taxes to West African countries.
The owner of the fishing vessel actually underdeclared the actual tonnage of their fishing vessel, which means that by that they pay less tax in terms of license fees to the coastal state.
The number of Chinese fishing boats operating in African waters has soared from 13 in 1985 to 462 in 2013. The huge increase in Chinese fishing vessels parallels growing Chinese investment and presence in the region. Kong says illegal fishing could damage Sino-African ties.
Yeah, the Chinese company are actually doing things opposite to what the Chinese government are doing in Africa. So I think that actually would undermine Sino-Africa relationship, because for local people in Africa, they will not distinguish between the company and the government.
China made an estimated $75 billion in investments in Africa from 2000 to 2011. In 2013, trade between China and the African continent totaled $200 billion. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Hong Kong.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
On Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best. right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Another protester was reported shot dead today in Burundi's capital, bringing the number of demonstrators killed in anti-government protests to 20. More than 900 migrants were rescued today on the Mediterranean by Italian and French naval vessels and a commercial ship. And President Obama is meeting with the Tunisian president at the White House today. Coming up, we'll have music from Togo, and in our feature segment, Boko Haram fighters indoctrinating female captives to their brand of radical Islam. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young, and happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday, Kim, and sporty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners.
Voice of America!
It's time to climb between the ropes once again with our reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moeta. Sporty greetings, Nnamdi!
And a greetings from Hollywood, California, Sonny.
Nnamdi Floyd Mayweather's recent victory over Manny Pacquiao, the highest grossing fight in boxing history. Can you give us an update on the figures so far?
Sonny, as we speak, they're still counting the money. What we have here now, and this is the first set of numbers, is 4.4 million domestic buy. When you tally that up, that comes to $400 million. Then you add in your life gate, which is $72 million. And remember again, 175 countries got this fight on foreign rights. So if you add that plus the closed circuit, you are looking at close to $700 million. We look at the two records of the pay-per-view big fights. The first one was 2.4 million Floyd Mayweather against Oscar De La Hoya. And the second one was 2.2 Floyd Mayweather against Canelo Alvarez. When you combine these two together, it's not even up to what happened May 2nd.
Let's say it does hit $700 million, Nnamdi. How does that break down between Mayweather and Pacquiao?
You remember before the fight, it was agreed upon to be 60-40. The cable companies will take their share, which is like 30%. Then Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao will go 60-40. At the end of the day, Money Mayweather will walk away with close to $400 million, and it breaks down to $6 million per second. Crazy paper, bro.
Nnamdi, soon after the fight, Mayweather said he was willing to give Pacquiao a rematch, but then in an interview with Showtime Television, he said he had changed his mind about that rematch. What's going on there?
Well, Manny Mayweather believed that Manny Pacquiao lied to the fight fans, that he was not honest about what happened before the fight. So he changed his mind, said there will be no rematch. But Manny Mayweather is a businessman. His nickname is Manny. Looking at the pile of money from the first one, I don't see him walking away from number two.
There are some question marks regarding Pacquiao's health right now, Nnamdi. He had surgery in Los Angeles for what was reported to be a torn rotator cuff on his right shoulder. Can you give us an update on that injury?
Well, Sonny, 4 days after the fight, May 2nd in Las Vegas, he came to Los Angeles, he had the operation, and it was successful. He will be out of action for the rest of the year. Don't expect him to fight 2015. But there are questions coming up now because we are yet to see the MRI of that shoulder. So people are beginning to feel that the shoulder SQ is like a decoy to cheat the fans and the boxing commission.
In terms of cheating the fans, Nnamdi, dozens of them have filed lawsuits regarding fraud surrounding the bout. What's that all about?
Well, the lawsuit says it's the fraud of the century, Sonny. because people pay lots of money. I mean, come on, Sonny. The suit is against Manny Pacquiao on Top Rank, but I believe they should also sue the Nevada State Boxing Athletic Commission for allowing the fight to go ahead.
You've seen the replays, Namdi. What's your impressions of Pacquiao and that injury? Was he hurt during the fight?
There was no injury. But Sonny, if you remember, before this fight, I've been talking about the way he prepared for this fight. There was really no concentration. They were just here in Hollywood doing what we call the Hollywood shuffle, you know. All these celebrities come into the gym and photo ops and so on. This guy's never even prepared for Mayweather. Look at the fight. Unable to cut off the ring. We're just running after Floyd Mayweather. So all this excuse about the shoulder, the leg, and all this stuff. He's lucky that the state boxing commission did not put a hold on his money, because he's going to walk away with close to $150 million, Sonny.
Floyd Mayweather has said he will fight again in September, Namdi. Who will be his next opponent?
Well, the September fight, Sonny, is a very important fight for Floyd Mayweather. That's when he ties Rocky Marciano's 49-0 record undefeated. Well, they're talking about American, but check this, Sonny. American has a very tough fight coming up May 29th in Brooklyn, New York City, and against Chris Algieri. If he looks really bad against Chris Algieri, or he gets knocked out by Chris Algieri, forget about the September fight with Money Mayweather. That aside, we're looking at people like Miguel Cotto. It will be a rematch because the first fight with Miguel Cotto and Mayweather was a very good one, even had Mayweather blooded a little bit. Miguel Cotto's got a tough fight in June against a UK fighter. He has to look good too. But we also have Victor Ortiz, and then all these players there, Danny Garcia. They're okay. You're not going to see $3, $4 million buy for any of these names I mentioned, Sonny.
What about this Triple G character, Namdi? I've heard his name. I know he fights a little above Mayweather's class. Any chance Mayweather would go against Golovkin?
Sonny, I was ringside because this fight was in my neighborhood at the Forum. This is an overrated, overhyped middleweight. He can't really fight. There's no competition in that division. That's why I really feel really bad when a very good middleweight from Ghana that was here for a while just went back home. He will have been in the mix now making good money. He's highly overrated. He's the world champion. There's really no need for Floyd Mayweather to fight him. He's not a big puncher. Even if rematch with Miguel Cotto and Floyd Mayweather means a lot, because that would be Floyd Mayweather moving up to capture the middleweight title. And Miguel Cotto is a big, big draw. I mean, he has a huge Latin base, Sonny.
Namdi, who are some of the top Africans in the mix right now?
Sonny, we have Joshua Clote. Joshua was on the same card with Canelo Alvarez, and then he looked really good. So Canelo and Joshua, it's a good chance for a big summer splash. Yeah. We're homeboy from Ghana. We'll walk away with close to more than $2 million. So hopefully that fight will happen. Because Canelo, after the destruction of James Coughlin on that card in Houston, I don't think anybody really wants to step in with Canelo. Canelo is hot right now. But a fight with Joshua Clotto and Canelo is a good one. Latif Kayode from Nigeria. Agbara, you remember him?
That's right. Raw power.
Raw power, man. He finally moved down to the cruiserweight, you know, so he was unable to take the power upstairs. So May 29 against Nick Kistner in Memphis, he will go for his cruiserweight fight, 10-rounder.
That's what I'm lucky for. That's why the people call me. In Nigeria, people call me Playboy, but that was my whole name.
Yeah.
But when I travel overseas, I'm like, I'm a lucky boy.
Lucky boy in Hollywood.
Lucky boy in Australia, lucky boy in Hollywood.
Then we have Lucky Boy Omota Show, Wally, June 20 at the MGM in Las Vegas. So that's happening. So we don't have that much, but these guys are on the scene now.
Namdi, getting back to Joshua Clote, I remember that really disappointing performance against Manny Pacquiao a few years ago, where he just basically kind of hid behind his gloves the whole fight. Do you think he'd bring it against Canelo if he gets that opportunity?
The fight you just mentioned is the one that fight fans always remember. Manny Pacquiao against Joshua Clote. Joshua Clote didn't do anything. That loss there against Pacquiao and his performance is what will make it hard for fight fans to buy Joshua Clote against Canelo. So it's not going to be an easy sell. And in the first place, why will Canelo take a tough fight against Joshua Clote, who doesn't really mean much for him? And he won't be bringing any big money to the dance.
Namdi, you mentioned that destruction by Canelo against James Kirkland. One of the best fights so far in 2015?
Definitely to go down as one of the best knockouts for 2015. If I'm Miguel Cotto's manager, because Miguel Cotto is supposed to fight Canelo next if he wins in June. If I'm Miguel Cotto's manager, I will be on the run with my fighter, man. That was a brutal knockout, Sonny. Total destruction of James Kirkland, who's a good fighter, too.
We were talking lawsuits earlier, Namdi, and Golden Boy, led by Oscar De La Hoya, has filed a lawsuit against Al Haymon, maybe the most powerful man in professional boxing right now. VOA! Tell our VOA fight fans about that.
Well, Sonny, Golden Boy Oscar De La Hoya filed a $300 million lawsuit against Al Haymon. You know, we're talking about violation of Muhammad Ali Boxing Reform Act.
And what is that?
This Reform Act was meant to protect fighters from exploitation. That is, fighters after their career, they have nothing to fall back on. They have medical issues. The money is gone with the promoter and the manager. But in the case of Al Haymon, he is the promoter and the manager, which means he's eliminating competition totally.
It's
like sitting on both sides of the table, you know, when you're making a deal. When a guy is sitting on both sides of the table, you can't make a deal, so it's not fair.
Do you think he's going to lose this lawsuit, Al Haymon?
There's two sides to the story, Sonny. Al Haymon today is the one bringing the biggest money to all the fighters in the game. Nobody's complaining about Al Haymon cheating them from the fight purse. So for the U.S. government to step in right now and break this up, it's not going to be easy. And not only that, Al Haymon is not just a hustler from the streets. You're talking about a Harvard-educated cat, you know. So he knows what he's doing, man. And he's
smart,
got his own
dude.
Life. Yeah, so he's not a hustler or a shakedown artist like we know in the game, you know. So he knows what he's doing, and he's got his own lawyer. Look, he put together an entity that gave him $400 million to do this Premier Boxing Championship.
And one final note on Haymon, Namdi. Do you think Mayweather-Pacquiao would have happened without his input?
No way. No way. This is the man that pulled everything together. This is the man that designed the promotion. This is the man that got all the money together. So it's going to be very hard for anybody to threaten this cat with a lawsuit that will make him run away. He's here to stay.
Thanks, Namdi. That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moeta.
VOA!
I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, Boko Haram fighters indoctrinating female captives to their brand of radical Islam. And next, the U.S. to stop Cameroonians posing as middlemen to help Cameroon businessmen get visas. But first, some music. Here is Hosti of Togo with Miasimi.
Yeah. Angolowa, angolowa. Ewla, miwla. Afi nambo. Fikpe anana. Fikpe anana. Evoyane toji. Enyane wane. Mama,
each other hug, cause I don't know why. We hate others, we all want blood. But different color, living in one world, sharing different nature. The same people, using different culture. As a god children, we need to love each other. Stop the blood sharing, cause little ones are dying. Little ones are dying.
Of Togo with Miasima.
Well, as they overtook large parts of Nigeria's northeast last year, Boko Haram fighters wanted to indoctrinate female captives to their brand of radical Islam and to marry them. Chris Stein reports on how the group used marriage to subjugate its captives.
During the 5 months the Boko Haram extremist group held Kolo Telba captive, the militants took away one of her sons, never to be seen again, and let another one become so sick that he died shortly after the Nigerian military rescued Telba late last month. One thing the militants didn't do was try to marry her. In fact, when they found out she was expecting, Telba says they left her and a group of other pregnant women alone. Telba says the fighters would bring the women food periodically, but generally the group was left alone. In the past few weeks, Nigeria's military has rescued hundreds of abducted women, girls, and children as it advanced into the Sambisa Forest, one of the extremist group's last strongholds. VOA spoke with some of the women who are among a group of 275 former captives brought to the Malkohi Displaced Persons Camp outside the northeastern city of Yola. Many describe Boko Haram fighters as being as preoccupied with marriage as they are with their six-year campaign to impose strict Islamic law across Nigeria's northeast. When the militants raided the town of Maidugali last August, they murdered Hadiza Yusuf's husband and took her away to Sambisa Forest. There, the fighters gave her a choice: marry one of them or become a slave. Yusuf refused to submit, so the militants forced her and other women to cook and do chores in the camp while raining insults on them. If they refused to do chores, the fighters would beat them. She isn't quite sure why the fighters wanted to get married so badly. Perhaps evil spirits possessed them, Yusuf says. Most of the fighters have about 5, 4, 3 women, and they're not even legally married to them. But Yusuf says they just want to have the women all to themselves. Hawal Umar found herself in Sambisa after she was taken from the town of Damboa last December. Faced with the choice of forced marriage or slavery, She says she faked a mental illness to avoid the fighters' advances. Umar says she put a lot of rags on her body and wore a worn-out cap and made herself look as rough as possible. She says the militants were scared of her and didn't want to come close to her, saying, "How can you get married to a mad woman?" They'd approach her and say, "This is a mad girl, stay away from her." And Yusuf says they'd run away. Not all of the women taken into Sambisa were able to resist the fighters. Authorities are still trying to figure out the exact number, but a spokesman for United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said last week that a large number of the women rescued from Sambisa were pregnant. Chris Stein for VOA News, Malkohi, Nigeria.
Thousands of Cameroonians apply to go to the United States each year for business, but many of them fall into the hands of people posing as middlemen for U.S. Embassy visa officials. U.S. Embassy officials have been working with Cameroonian judicial police to arrest and prosecute suspects and applicants who present fraudulent documents. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has the story from Yaoundé.
Lillian Betze is one among hundreds of Cameroonians asking for visas at the United States Embassy in Yaoundé early this week. She says it was the third time she was coming for an interview to travel to America.
I've been here several times. Each time I come, they ask me to present so many documents. They say I should bring marriage certificate, my academic certificate, bank statement. It's not been very easy. They ask me so many documents. I will go and come back after. They will still ask so many documents, and it's not been very easy.
Last Wednesday, Cameroon State Radio, CRTV, invited officials of the United States Embassy in Yaoundé to explain why there have been complaints that procedures to acquire visas are at times long and cumbersome. Consular official Nicholas Castellano says there are lots of fraudulent documents in a majority of the application files, and as such, they work with the Cameroon police to authenticate suspected documents.
A majority of Cameroonians' visa applicants come to the American Embassy with a fraudulent document. The most fraudulent types that we see are the introduction or business employment letters, financial statements, university transcripts. And so we've been able to partner with the judicial police and had numerous people in the last few months arrested. The judicial police do an investigation, take custody of the person, and then proceed them through the Cameroonian legal system.
Castellano says they have been able to turn many of the arrested suspects. He says it is both in their interest and that of the Cameroon government to have a fraud-free, fluid, and very easy process for everyone who has a legitimate application and good documents. Kweke Emmanuel of Cameroon's Judicial Police says there are well-established networks of visa frauds and middlemen claiming to represent U.S. Embassy staff in Cameroon. He says they even arrested a suspect who had obtained a fake police identification badge and always wore a police uniform before deceiving people that he could facilitate the process to establish visas at the United States Embassy. He says many of such suspects have been detained and are helping the police in their investigations. Emmons of the Communication and Public Relations Department of the Cameroon Police Force says they have been urging Cameroonians to visit the United States Embassy for all visa requirements and to report all suspects to the police.
8 personnes ont été écrouées à la prison centrale de Yaoundé pour ces motifs. Leur rôle...
He says many people are awaiting trial for fabricating fake documents and certificates for people requesting visas. He says some of them even went to parents who intended to send their children for studies out of Cameroon, promising that they could help. Roberto Quiroz, public affairs officer of the United States Embassy in Cameroon, says they will continue the battle along with Cameroon's judicial police to clear the system of all fraudulent people whose goal is to extort money from visa applications.
The message is that we want visa peddlers to be out of office. Visa peddlers must be out of business because a lot of Cameroonians qualify for visas, and when they listen to the siren song, they fall prey to the corrupt practices of these people. So they qualify for visas to see family and friends, but they lose this opportunity because they violated the Cameroonian laws.
The U.S. Department of State Bureau of Consular Affairs states that attempting to obtain a visa by the willful misrepresentation of a material fact or fraud may result in the permanent refusal of a visa or denial of entry into the United States. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wojtek Zorniak, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
10 years ago, the administration of then-President George W. Bush launched the President's Malaria Initiative, or PMI, a $1.2 billion program that aimed to reduce by half deaths from malaria in 15 of the hardest-hit countries in Africa. In 2008, the program was expanded to 19 African countries and the greater Mekong subregion. Over the past decade, working through this initiative, the United States and its partners have helped the target countries make significant strides toward controlling malaria. PMI coordinator Rear Admiral Timothy Zimmer and Global HIV/AIDS coordinator Ambassador Deborah Birx, MD, wrote recently in a blog that the contributions of PMI, together with those of other partners, have dramatically improved coverage of key malaria control interventions, including use of insecticide-treated mosquito nets, indoor residual spraying, accurate diagnosis and prompt treatment, and intermittent preventative treatment of pregnant women. Indeed, according to the World Health Organization, since 2001, malaria deaths have decreased by 47% globally. That's over 4 million lives spared. Most of that progress has taken place since 2005. Still, according to the WHO, in 2013 alone, malaria sickened some 198 million people and killed 584,000 of them. Clearly, more needs to be done. The 2005 President's Malaria Initiative expires at the end of this year, and so the administration of President Barack Obama has formulated a new plan that will take us through 2020. The new strategy begins with the ultimate goal of eliminating malaria everywhere. To get us started over the next 5 years, we will work with our partners to reduce malaria mortality in PMI countries by one-third from today's levels. That means malaria levels 80% lower than they were in 2000. We will also work to reduce the occurrence of malaria within PMI populations by 40% from today's levels and help at least five PMI-supported countries to meet the World Health Organization criteria for pre-elimination. There is no greater joy than knowing children, mothers, and communities are thriving because malaria no longer ravages villages, wrote program coordinators Zimmer and Birx. America's result-driven global health assistance saves and improves lives, reduces long-term health costs, and lays the foundation for sustainable development in the world's poorest countries.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.